Skyrocketing insulin prices are a national problem, and people with diabetes are doing what they can to cope with high prices while asking state and federal governments for more accountability and more options on how to get access to life-saving insulin. People who can't afford their medication may resort to taking smaller doses or skipping it altogether, which could be deadly. The American Diabetes Association calls diabetes a national epidemic, and it's expensive. We're looking at the insulin marketplace, the politics, the pharmaceuticals who make it, and the patients who need it to live. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tiffany Stanley is a writer and editor based in Washington, D.C. Her recent piece for the Washington Post magazine is called Life, Death, and Insulin. Tiffany, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
So this is a life-saving drug for millions of Americans, yet you write in your piece, it seems we're getting further and further out of reach for people who need it the most. How much has the price of this drug gone up?
Yeah, in the last decade, the price of insulin has tripled. So a 10 milliliter vial that, you know, in 1996 when it came out cost $21 is now $275. And that's true across the board for a lot of insulin products.
Even with insurance, is insulin still setting people back a lot?
It is. It's not that much. People that are underinsured or don't have insurance are the ones that are paying the list price. But a recent small study found that even among insured patients, one in four report rationing their insulin because of the cost. Because of co-pays and because of paying a percentage of that list price, it's still creating a financial burden.
So who are these companies making insulin? Introduce us to the marketplace.
So part of the reason that a lot of activists talk about this is because the market is dominated by three main companies, the American company Eli Lilly, the French company Sanofi, and the Danish firm Novo Nordisk. And they control, I think, like 90% of the American insulin market.
So in terms of controlling the insulin market, these are name brand products. Are there generics out there, or how does that work?
It's a confusing system when it comes to insulin because of the way the FDA registers insulin. And it's actually called something called a biologic, and it's much more complicated to make in some ways. So unfortunately, because of the way things have been regulated, we don't have any true kind of generic interchangeable insulins. We have two new what are called follow-on insulins, but they're only marginally cheaper than the name brands. So that's one of the things that policymakers are looking at, it are ways to kind of get more competition so we can drive those prices down.
So what have the Eli Lillys out there said about these rising prices of this drug? What is accounting for this?
Well, it's another part of our drug pricing system that's very confusing because there's a lot of secrecy about how these drugs are priced, how the prices are raised. These companies don't talk about their pricing strategies. They tend to say, you know, there's a lot of factors involved, including how insurance companies price things, about how pharmacy benefit managers who help us get our drug coverage, how they price things. And it's this system, but as one expert told me, it's a bit of a black box. We actually don't know what's going on behind the scenes.
In this black box, there's been talk about price fixing. Is there any sense that these companies are perhaps in cahoots with each other?
Those are the allegations. I mean, we don't have evidence of that, but there are a lot of investigations that have popped up in the last couple years. Attorneys general are doing investigations. There's a civil lawsuit that's making its way through the courts. And all of these folks are looking at, are they price fixing? Are they raising prices in lockstep? Because right now it looks like they are, but we don't currently have evidence that that's the case. But as some of these court cases and investigations in Congress and otherwise get underway, we might be able to find out more evidence about that.
talking with Tiffany Stanley. She's a writer and editor based in Washington. Her recent piece for the Washington Post magazine is called Life, Death, and Insulin. Are you a diabetic? If so, are you feeling the pain of rising insulin prices? Call in at 800-642-1234. Have you been forced to ration insulin? If so, tell us about it and how has it affected your life? Call in or email ideas at WPR.org. Tiffany, in the way that you write about insulin, in some ways you say it serves as a proxy for the rising prices across the U.S. prescription drug market. How do you see it that way?
I think that drug pricing has become a huge issue. There were polls that came out in the past year or two just showing how many Americans think this is a really important issue and really want Congress and the Trump administration to do something about it. It was a big campaign trail promise of President Trump. And so we're seeing that we just have this pricing system, as we talked about, that's a black box, that we don't always know what's going on behind the scenes. And there's been a lot of sort of movement, at least in activist circles and in policy circles, to start to figure out what's going on and how can we lower those prices.
A lot of your piece revolves around a family and Alec Rishon Smith. Can you introduce us to his story and what happened there?
Yes. Yeah, so Alec was a young type 1 diabetic. He was diagnosed in his early 20s, and he was turning 26, and like a lot of 26-year-olds, was about to be sort of age out of his mother, Nicole Smith Holt's, insurance policy. And what they found was just that his options on the marketplace were just very expensive. So he made the decision to go without insurance, perhaps not realizing just how much his insulin would cost. But it ended up being his supplies and his insulin were more than $1,300 a month. He made $35,000 a year. So it was something that he could ill afford. He ended up dying from something called diabetic ketoacidosis, which tends to happen when you don't have enough insulin in your system. And his family pieced together after he died that he was struggling within that month of not having insurance. And they came to the conclusion that he had been rationing. And that is what led to his death.
Mm. Let's bring in McKinsey now, joining us from Baraboo. McKinsey, what are your thoughts here?
Well, it's just really, really upsetting and discouraging. My husband is type 1 diabetic. He's been like that since he was a child. And so it's not something that, you know, his lifestyle brought upon him. And the fact that now that he's well into his 30s, he's an extremely healthy diabetic, actually. And there are times, and he makes good money, we do okay, but there are times where he panics. We all panic. Because we cannot get, like, if he runs out of insulin early, which happens from time to time, and you have to pay full price, and that's very expensive. There have also been instances where we've almost resorted to going, you know, becoming a part of, like, the diabetic groups that they have. They have them on Facebook. They have other support groups and blogs. And they exchange diabetic supplies, which is very dangerous. You shouldn't do that, but people are resorting to these things because they want to survive. And the American, like, our system in this country is failing these people, especially the ones who, you were just born with it. And they're contributors to society, they work hard every single day, and all they want to do is live and go home to their families.
McKinsey, I'm going to pause right there with your stories because we're getting closer to the break here. And Tiffany, we'll get back to you on that and this idea of diabetics exchanging supplies to get by. Your thoughts on insulin, 800-642-1234. Are you a diabetic? And if so, are you feeling the pain of rising insulin prices? What do you do about it? Call in, email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to the conversation in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. Insulin is a naturally occurring hormone secreted by the pancreas. Many people with diabetes are prescribed insulin either because their bodies do not produce insulin, that would be type 1, or the body does not use insulin properly, type 2. We're talking about the soaring cost of insulin on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and Tiffany Stanley stays with us. She's a writer and editor based in Washington. Her recent piece for the Washington Post magazine is called Life, Death, and Insulin, and we're gathering your thoughts at 800-642-1234. What challenges have you faced in trying to get affordable access to this drug? Have you stretched your insulin doses to get by in a month? And what do you think could be done to bring down the cost of insulin? Call in, tweet us at WPR Mornings. Tiffany, before we went to the break, McKinsey was making two points. First point is that when her spouse starts running low or runs out in a month, then you have to pay full price and to get by for the rest of the month. And then what about exchanging insulin supplies and support groups?
That was something I heard from a lot of diabetics who talked about, maybe their prescription wasn't quite right and they needed more insulin in a month, or they ran into insurance coverage issues. I talked to a young woman, Hattie Saltzman, who went nearly a year without buying insulin. She's a college student and her bill per month was $550. So she shared some with her dad, she got samples from her doctor, and eventually some family friends donated leftover insulin to her. And that was something I heard repeated by a lot of diabetics, this kind of black market, these Facebook groups, GoFundMe accounts, people just trying anything they can to get by.
Let's go to Michael now, joining us from Oconomowoc. Michael, hi.
Hey, how are you doing? I'm a physician. I just thought I'd give some perspective. I'm describing, not prescribing, this practice, but I think part of the issue with the pricing is insurance companies will pay, if you have insurance, for higher priced insulin. So they get paid more if the drug companies will get paid more if they price it higher. So unfortunately, if you don't have insurance, you're stuck with that high price. They can't give two different prices or bigger prices. So that's probably one thing that happens. I do have a number of patients who unfortunately are stuck, and one of the options that they do is using NPH or regular that they can get through Walmart for a lot cheaper cost. It's not the preferred insulin because of the pharmacodynamics of the levels of insulin in the blood, but it is a backup, and it's what I used when I was in med school in the 90s. We have much better insulins that we can use now, but if that's all our choice, that is much more affordable, a fraction of what.
Michael, do you see patients having difficulty affording their insulin?
And that's what I'm saying. I do have some, and that's the option that we have to go to. That's, unfortunately, even with insurance, sometimes there's a high deductible, so you're having to pay hundreds of dollars. There's non-insulin for type 2 diabetics. There's things like Victoza and Byetta, Bydureon, that are $600-$700 a month. I advocate, especially with type 2 diabetes, which is different than type 1, lifestyle as best you can, because it's so expensive to treat diabetes. When you get into anything above simple generic metformin, you're getting into these, you're talking, $1,000 potentially a month.
And Michael, very quickly, I know you probably have to get going here, but how expensive are insulin pumps? And when you start looking at delivery systems of insulin?
As far as pricing, that's going to be a higher price. I mean, that's sometimes a barrier as well for many people. I mean, so that's going to be, often using the same insulins, but now you have that pump mechanism in there, and so that's going to be more expensive.
Well, Michael, thank you so much for calling in. Tiffany, you write in your piece about the Walmart grade of insulin. What are your thoughts there?
Yes, it was something that a number of physicians and a and my pharmacist told me about these so-called Walmart insulin. It's available for $25 a vial, so clearly much cheaper than the newer ones. It's something that, you know, doctors said, you know, it's good insulin. It's obviously better than nothing. But it was something that especially type 1 diabetics are very opposed to that being a solution. They find that they give them dangerously low blood sugars, and it's much harder to control their blood sugar levels. Some research bears that out. I think some researchers find that for type 2 diabetics who don't need insulin in quite the same way, that those insulins can be fine. But it's something that I think a number of type 1 diabetics sort of don't want that to be the solution. They want to be able to use the state-of-the-art insulins.
Tiffany, let's turn to politics for a moment here. President Trump has talked about the need to bring down the cost of prescription drugs and unveiled his American Patients First plan earlier this year. What does this plan look like, and what could it mean for the price of drugs like insulin?
So it's a blueprint, and it includes, you know, more than 50 proposals. It has a lot of different ideas, but it's really just a framework at this point. The administration has started at the policy level, looking at different options and putting some initial things into place. But it's really too soon to kind of know exactly what the government is really going to do. But there has been moves at the FDA to get more generics on the market, to, you know, try to figure out, you know, how we can lower these prices specifically for insulin too.
How have you seen lawmakers responding to this rising cost of insulin?
There has been a lot of activity on Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle. I think they're in the Senate and in the House, there are a lot of lawmakers who are hearing from their constituents, some that are parents of type 1 diabetic children who have been active on this issue. A report just came out in November from a House committee that, you know, is kind of calling on Congress to legislate and start to kind of put some market controls on insulin prices.
So while politicians are trying to hammer things out here, diabetics are still stuck with these prices. Where else might they be turning to in order to try to get cheaper insulin?
Well, there have been some reports of folks trying to get supplies from Canada or Mexico. It's technically illegal to import medication from other countries, but the FDA doesn't generally prosecute individuals if it's a short-term supply for their personal use. So I know one father testified in front of I think the Senate that a 90-day supply of his son's insulin was, you know, almost $1,500. So he started getting it from a Canadian pharmacy for about $300. So that you sort of see that other countries regulate their drugs and cap the price. And because the U.S. does not, we kind of have this imbalance.
And what about the activist movement? Have we seen people organizing around this issue?
Yes, one of the most active social media campaigns that I saw was hashtag insulin for all. And it was started by a group called T1 International. They're based in the UK. And it was originally started as a way to raise awareness about developing countries having problems accessing insulin. And it caught on in the US, a little bit of a surprise in that way that, you know, and as the founder said, you know, it's a shame that a rich country like the US also needs a campaign like this.
Mm. Take us back to the family of Alec Rayshon Smith. How are they moving on in their lives, and how are they advocating in the wake of their son's death?
I mean, Nicole and her family have just become, you know, relentless activists on this issue. She's visited the campus of Eli Lilly. She just went to Sanofi. She has become, you know, she gives speeches. She's talked in front of the Senate Committee of Democrats. I mean, she's just doing everything she can because to her, she's leaving a legacy for Alec, and she wants to make sure that other people don't die the way that he did.
Are there plans to follow up on this reporting? Like, where does this go from here?
I mean, I think we're at the beginning of seeing some real movement and change happening, especially given it just seems like we're reaching a tipping point, that there's a lot of people at high levels of government that feel very strongly about this issue, and there's a lot of activists. So I think in the next couple of years, we may see some changes or some policies that come down that maybe do some good.
Are there any practical pieces of advice you could give diabetics about how to manage their costs for insulin and the challenges that they encounter each month?
I mean, I think that one of the biggest challenges is that if you do not have good insurance, it's a very expensive disease. And so that's something that a lot of people are running into, especially people that are self-insured, where they have those high deductible policies. And I think someone like Alec maybe thought, oh, I can't afford to have this really expensive insurance. I'll just pay for my medications out of pocket. And unfortunately, with being a diabetic, that becomes insurmountable cost. So I think, unfortunately, it's not something that patients, it should be on them to, you know, do it better. I think it's that our system has not supported them in the way that they need to.
Well, Tiffany, thank you so much for joining us.
All right. Thank you so much.
Tiffany Stanley is a writer and editor based in Washington, and her piece for The Washington Post magazine is called Life, Death, and Insulin. Up next, it's news, and we have you always wanted to join the Peace Corps, but you feel you might have missed your chance. Our next guest makes the case that it's not too late. We'll learn the ins and outs of being a Peace Corps volunteer. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. Their mission is peace and friendship. There are more than 7,000 Peace Corps volunteers scattered in far-flung places around the world, working in high-poverty environments for two solid years. We're exploring the Peace Corps on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The Goodwill Agency was created by President John F. Kennedy in 1961 to send American volunteers to live and work in developing countries and then to return home to share what they had learned and experienced. Kate Schachter is the UW Campus Peace Corps recruiter. She served as a Peace Corps volunteer twice, once traveling to Ghana, and more recently, the Republic of Georgia. Kate, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting us.
Well, give us the lay of the land for a Peace Corps volunteer. What are the opportunities like?
Many opportunities. We hire anywhere from 3,500 to 4,000 per year. So those 7,000 volunteers are swapping in and out. There we have opportunities in the fields of education, health, agriculture, environment, youth development, and community economic development. And all of those all have a component of education. In other words, we are always teaching and learning from as well. People that we're working with.
Wow. And so Peace Corps volunteers, I mean, I often think of a Peace Corps volunteer in a village situation, but that might not necessarily be the case.
Yeah, the traditional picture of a volunteer in a mud hut is not necessarily true. When I served in the Republic of Georgia, I was in quite a large city.
What was it like for you in the Republic of Georgia? What was that experience like?
It was just as amazing as my time in Ghana, but in such a different way. I mean, there were so many things that were different. But it was welcoming. The people were welcoming. I was working with an environmental organization that was doing outreach on environmental issues, climate change, flood control, recycling projects. And my primary project was to work with them to help them with networking, fundraising, and reaching out to youth on climate change issues and how to keep a clean environment.
Did you feel like you made a difference?
I felt I did, and I still have good friends there that I feel show that I did make a difference. Yes. I feel that I did.
And how long do the programs usually last?
It depends. The usual program, the two-year program that everyone thinks of, is for the volunteers. That's available. Probably about 94% of the jobs are the two-year program. 6% of us, well, not 6%. Well, I think it's about 4%. So 96% are two-year jobs. 4% are response positions, which are 6 to 12 months. So my time in Georgia was a response position. And those are for people who already have very specific skills. You apply to a really specific job, you know exactly where you're going, and they're looking for someone to just dive in and get to work pretty fast.
I read that the average age of the Peace Corps volunteer is 28.
Correct.
Yeah, so what does a 28-year-old then bring to this environment?
They bring curiosity, enthusiasm, dynamic energy. I mean, not that I didn't have that as an over 50 volunteer myself, but I think that is what they really bring. They bring a fresh look at a problem. They've come right out of college typically. So there's a lot that a 28-year-old brings to the table.
We're talking with Kate Schachner right now. She is UW Campus Peace Corps recruiter and volunteer. And you can join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. Were you a Peace Corps volunteer? How did that experience change you? Perhaps you're considering joining the Peace Corps. What concerns do you have? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Kate, this sense of duty to serve, responding to President John F. Kennedy's call, the themes of volunteering, of friendship, of peace, how much does the commitment to service factor into the work of the Peace Corps?
Hugely. It's one of the key qualifications. There are 10 core values of a Peace Corps volunteer, and that is one of the core values. We are there in another country. Our expenses are covered. Our housing is provided. We do have a living stipend. But there is so much that is all about service, about working with people from another culture, from way outside our zone of comfort. And we have to be committed to the idea of service. In fact, I would say that one of the key ways that you can prepare for Peace Corps is to get involved in service opportunities here in the United States before you go, to make sure that it resonates with you.
Yeah, and how difficult is it to get into the Peace Corps? Is that process pretty challenging, or what is that like?
It's not challenging, but it is competitive.
Okay, that was the word I was looking for.
Yes, we get about 20,000 to 25,000 applications per year for those 4,000 jobs, 3,500 to 4,000 jobs per year. So yes, it's very competitive. Let me put that in a little bit of perspective. Probably a third of those people voluntarily withdraw, or they fall in love, or they they get the job of their dreams, they run into some health or family issues, so they have to just pull out. So there's, you know, you're not up against
squishy.
All 20,000.
Right, right. Let's go to Bob now, joining us from La Crosse with thoughts. Bob, hi.
Hi.
Go ahead. What was your experience?
Well, I'm just wondering. I'm 68. My wife's 67. We're both nurses. Is there any opportunity for us to be involved?
Absolutely. I can tell you that the oldest volunteer right now in Peace Corps is 82-year-old woman, living and working in Malawi as a health volunteer, and her entire life, her career was as a nurse. So she's doing a lot of work with people in Malawi, mostly around HIV/AIDS, but also nutrition and general health.
Do you see Peace Corps volunteers who are entering retirement and looking for that next opportunity, that next challenge, closing out a career perhaps?
Yes, absolutely. And it happens not just in retirement, but really anywhere in the midstream. So there's 28 years old and there's 50 plus year olds, but in between there are a lot of people who are going through transitions in their life.
Let's go to Madeline now, joining us from Madison. Hi, Madeline.
Hi. I was a Peace Corps volunteer, also over 50, actually over 60, and I wanted to ask about the unexpected gifts, because as a Peace Corps volunteer, I was so surprised how much time I had to read. And the first time in my life, you know, I was reading 150 books and just loving that. And also for the first time in my life, I really felt like I was asked to think about the challenging global issues and to try to figure them out, to be sitting on the front lines of poverty and truly understanding it.
Do you feel like it changed you, Madeline, changed you in your life?
Oh, it was such a gift. There were just so many unexpected gifts, and that was why I wanted to ask Kate from her perspective what she didn't expect to learn and did learn.
Thank you so much, Madeline. Kate, what are those unexpected gifts?
There are many. You gain friendships with people that you never expected to meet in your life. You gain, and then these can become permanent friendships that you continue to support them or their family through, whether it's communication or financially. You have a strong connection. You have time in secondary projects. You take on, in Peace Corps, you have a primary project, and then you can also take on any secondary projects that the community needs and that you feel that you can accomplish with them and fundraise for. And those are opportunities to get you to reach outside of your zone of comfort again and really challenge your business, your development, your thinking skills.
And so you bring all those skills back with you after your service is complete in the Peace Corps. Can you help us understand how the Peace Corps is funded and how it keeps going as an organization?
Sure. The Peace Corps is funded through the International Affairs budget. So it's, what is it, perhaps Peace Corps is perhaps 1% of that, which is about 1% of the total budget. And so it is a federally run, taxpayer-funded program, and it is funded through a budget process.
And right now, impacted by the current partial government shutdown.
It is, but there are enough Peace Corps staff in the United States, and none of the staff, as far as I'm aware, I don't really know the details, but none of the staff in country where the volunteers are have been furloughed. It's called Field the Shield. It's important to take care of the volunteers in the field. We know that we have America's most precious resource out there, the people, and it's important to take care of them. So the volunteers are in good hands, but people who are trying to get in are kind of waiting for things.
Waiting in the wings, right? And we're talking about 7,000 volunteers all over the globe right now.
Correct.
That's a lot of people out there who are doing service in so many different settings.
Yep.
In the decades since its inception, the Peace Corps has sent thousands of volunteers to live and work in developing countries around the world to further peace and development. And the Peace Corps is currently serving 64 countries. As we've been talking about, the average age of a Peace Corps volunteer is 28. And we're getting the specifics on the Peace Corps with Kate Schachner as our guide. She's the UW Campus Peace Corps recruiter and volunteer. You can join in with your stories, 800-642-1234. Were you a Peace Corps volunteer? How did that experience change you, and what did you learn? Perhaps you're considering joining the Peace Corps. What do you think about? What concerns do you have? 800-642-1234. When we come back, we'll talk with a Wisconsinite about getting ready to go to Senegal as a Peace Corps volunteer this winter. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Peace Corps Week, the 58th anniversary of the Peace Corps, is February 24th through March 2nd, and you can learn more about the application process, get involved through a series of events with former volunteers and details at peacecorps.wisc.edu. We're talking with Kate Schachner. She's the UW Campus Peace Corps recruiter and volunteer. Let's bring in another voice now, Kevin Susie. He served in the Wisconsin State Assembly from 1975 to 1980. He was 20 years old when he was elected, serving three terms, one as the chairman of the Transportation Committee. And throughout his career, he worked as a transportation consultant and lobbyist. He also served as Milwaukee County's Director of Intergovernmental Relations. Now retired, Kevin Susie will depart for Senegal as a Peace Corps volunteer this winter. Kevin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate.
So here you are, 65, recently retired from a long career. You've also worked for Milwaukee County and served in the state assembly. Why did you decide to join the Peace Corps?
Well, you know, it's something that I had been thinking about for quite some time. It was actually something I was thinking about doing when I was quite young, but other things kind of got in the way, like running for the legislature in college and then life. So it was kind of there in the back of my mind. And once I retired and found myself in a fairly unencumbered position, I revisited the idea and thought very carefully about it. It's not an easy decision to make, as your guest Kate was explaining. But finally decided. While I was in the legislature, I started studying French at the UW in Madison to prepare to go to school in Montreal. And I kind of have kept up with French throughout my life. So when I was looking for countries, I began looking at the French-speaking world in Africa. And that's how I arrived at Senegal. So I applied, and here we are.
So what will you be doing in Senegal? What's your mission?
Well, I applied as a community health support agent. And I'm not exactly sure what I'll be doing. I'm told that I will not be administering health care directly to people. But they also, during my interview, asked me if I was interested in getting involved with economic development as well. So I go into it totally flexible. I want to be able to allow them to match me with the most appropriate project in the most appropriate location.
Are you ready to essentially feel out of your comfort zone for a couple years?
Well, you know, that's the question. And you know, all my life I've kind of pushed myself outside my comfort zone, and every time I've done it, it's been uncomfortable. But almost always, something wonderful happens. And in this case, I'm way outside my comfort zone. But I have the same expectation with this, and from what I hear from other volunteers, return volunteers, the rewards of the experience are just wonderful.
We're talking with Kevin Susie, former lawmaker and transportation expert, soon to be Peace Corps volunteer. Let's go back to the phones now with Amy joining us from Madison. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
Go ahead. What's on your mind about the Peace Corps?
Hi. So I'm really appreciating this conversation that you're having this morning. I always wanted to join the Peace Corps and kind of passed that age and went into my career. But my question is, I'm thinking about my retirement. I'm in my 50s, and I'm starting to have some minor health problems. And I'm wondering, you had talked about older volunteers, but I'm not as athletic as I used to be, and I wonder if there are sites that can be safe for older volunteers who may have health situations.
Amy, thank you so much for that question. Kate, can you address that?
Sure, absolutely. Like I said, Peace Corps considers the people that it sends to other countries to be its most precious resource. And when they place you, when you go through all of this work, a process that can take 6 to 9 months just to get from submitting an application to leaving the country, they want to make sure that you're going to be safe and happy and secure in the place that you're sent. So, for example, I mentioned my time in the Republic of Georgia. I was living in a big city, and it was quite safe. It was the safest environment I've actually been in a long time. Mm. Even though Ghana was very similar in safety, it was still safe and secure. In terms of health, you do have to pass a certain level of health screening. They're not testing you, but you will be screened for placement. So if you've got certain health conditions and Peace Corps doesn't feel they can support you in certain countries, they'll let you know that you're only eligible to apply for the other specific countries. And then after you get invited to serve, then you start going through the actual medical. You have your doctors kind of confirm any details.
Amy, thank you for the call. Jerry in Amory. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
I'm an old-timer. I joined the Peace Corps when I was 19 and began my training in June of 1962. I was finished my sophomore year at the University in Madison and spent 3 months in training and then 21 months on the island of Mindanao in the Philippines. And in terms of a lifetime vocation, I think I made an absolutely fabulous choice because I've maintained my interest in the Peace Corps and my memories and almost on a daily basis. I spent 43 years as a editor of the newspaper in Amory, a family operation, and in that capacity had an opportunity to deal with situations that reminded me of the Philippines all the time.
Oh, Jerry, thank you so much for that memory. And he's one of the very first generations of the Peace Corps, very first classes, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Right, and his experiences would be so different than what they are today. The communication, the technology, the access in the world. I mean, yes, you can end up in remote places, but in general, it's very different environment.
Kevin Susie, back to you. In 1974, you were elected to the State Assembly. You were only 20 at the time. You weren't able to join the Peace Corps back then, but you were serving in a different way. How did your three terms in the State Assembly shape you and your career and perhaps maybe even lead you to this?
I come from a family that was fairly political and really stressed service. My parents were huge supporters of President Kennedy, and I remember my mom using the line from JFK's inaugural address: "They ask not what your country can do for you; ask what you can do for your country." And I heard that quite often around the house. And so those were the sort of things that got planted in my brain. And so it was kind of natural to go into service, at elected office. I left because I ran practically out of high school and I wanted to make sure I get my college degrees in the process and on with the rest of life.
Well, Kevin, I have to stop.
That desire to serve has always been there.
Thank you so much for your time. Kevin Susie, former lawmaker and transportation expert, soon to be Peace Corps volunteer. And Kay, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity.
Kay Jackner is a UW campus Peace Corps recruiter, served in the Peace Corps as a volunteer twice. More information about the application process and events is at peacecorps.wisc.edu. Just ahead, the lands we share, where our food comes from, who grows it. We'll look at that exhibition. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.